session number 5210, Reel 4.
Mr. Benborough, Reel 4.
Well, in Osaka, we had many earth tremors and earthquakes. Quite frequently, severe tremors. And I remember being in the cement works, in the middle of all this machinery, in the, during an earthquake. And it was quite terrifying. I made a quick exit onto the road outside. On another occasion, some of the high chimneys fell down because of the earthquakes. And I followed all the Japs workers into a roadway where there was a tram lines, and they were sitting on the tram lines in the middle of the road. So I did likewise. I thought, what's good enough for them is good enough for me, obviously, to avoid buildings on each side of the road from falling down. It was a miserable job, cementos. There was nothing to be had. It was far better to work on the ships, unloading the beans, or the rice, or the sugar, or salt, where there was something of benefit. But if anybody went in the cement works, there was nothing whatever to eat, except a rice ball. A rice ball would be as big as a tennis ball. And everybody had one of those for his lunch at midday. And that was the only thing that you ever got from the people at Cementos. I was in Osaka then continually until the bombing started. When the bombing started, March the 13th, there was a big daylight raid in Osaka, and June the 1st was a night raid.
Which year was this?
1945. And it was when the camp was burnt down in the day raid. And when we got back to the camp from our various working parties, the camp was complete red hot ashes. That's all was remaining of the camp. And the only belongings anybody had was actually what he was standing up wearing. There was no water. I remember we had to roll water in barrels for 2 or 3 miles down the streets to bring back to the camp. And then holes were dug in the ground. And then fires made in order to boil some rice. We were then moved to another camp. The other camp was a dilapidated building which was flea-ridden and bug-ridden again, and lousy. Everybody was covered in lice. All his clothes were lousy. And when we went to work, we used to take off all our clothes and try to get all the lice off, and if possible have a swim.
Was this other camp still in Osaka?
This is still in Osaka, yes. This is in Osaka. They used to lock us in godowns during the air raids, and the Japanese guards themselves would go into air raid shelters. But their system of knowing the planes, because obviously if bombing planes, American bombers, flew over the southern island of Japan, Shikoku, and were making their way for Honshu, they would telegraph up to Honshu and tell them how many planes were coming. And the guards would shout one to another around how many. Haku is 100. I remember hearing Ichihaku, Nihaku, Sanhaku, Gohaku. So we knew then there were 500 planes were on the way, and they were either coming to Wakayama or Osaka or Kobe. When we were locked in the godowns, I noticed that the Chinese were absolutely petrified of being locked in the godowns.
Which Chinese were these?
They were Chinese prisoners. Chinese prisoners were in another camp, but during air raids, we used to go together in this place, in this big warehouse.
Were they civilians or military?
The Chinese, I think they were soldiers, possibly brought back from China, because the Japanese-China war had been on since 1937, hadn't it? And I did hear that they had, the Chinese had a chap there who was a collaborator with the Japanese, and they didn't wait, at the end of the war, they didn't wait for a trial, they just executed him themselves.
Why were they so frightened of being locked up?
I think Chinese are. I think the Chinese build and their outlook is far different from a British. I think we were more inclined to be more relaxed and accept things as they come and not to panic. No benefit is derived from screaming in circumstances like that. But I know that the Chinese were absolutely terrified.
So they actually used to scream out?
Oh, yes, they did. When the end of the war got nearer, all sorts of rumours about what was happening. I used to talk to a chap in the cement work. We used to call him Chesty. I never knew his real name, but he was a Japanese. And I remember I used to draw a map on the cement, on the ground with a stick, of Japan and the Pacific era. And then he told me once where the Americans had advanced to. So we knew that the Americans were in fact getting nearer to Japan. And I also knew that when they got sufficiently near to establish air bases, that the bombing would intensify.
Was it not dangerous for the Japanese to give you this information?
It was, but if he'd have been found, he would have probably been for the chop. But I knew him so well, and I wormed it out of him. And the Japanese, the equivalent of the German SS, are the Kempis, Kempitai. And we used to get them in the camp. And I remember once working on the pig iron on a ship, and nets were being lowered down. We were loading the pig iron onto the nets, four nets. There were prisoners, horios, loading two of the nets, and Japanese coolies loading the other two. And I recognized, on one occasion, a Kempitai with the coolies. And I went up to him and recognized him. He then disappeared, but obviously he'd been put down there to try to hear what we were saying, because he could speak English very well. Whether he was trying to find out what information we had about the advance of the Allied forces nearer to Japan, I don't know. About the working parties in Japan, there was a Japanese soldier. His name was Kondor. Now, he was the man, he was only a little man, but he was the man responsible for the numbers who had to be produced for all the working parties. He would say 30 men for Kitamura, 25 for Nagatane, and so on all the way through. And if the numbers were not reached, then he would take sick men to fill up the numbers, because he said he had to make the numbers. On one occasion, we carried a man, his name was Fieldhouse, to work on a stretcher. He was so ill, but he had to be taken, and he had to come to work in spite of the fact that we carried him. We carried him to work. He lay down on his stretcher all day. He just had water and possibly a little bit of rice. And then we carried him home at night, and he died that night when we got him home. His name was Fieldhouse. Of course, we all hated Condor, him being responsible for that. I sometimes wonder whether Matsumoro really wasn't responsible, because he was a camp commandant and should have been aware of what his staff were doing. When the bombing intensified, we used to carry rice out of the rice store into piles in the streets. 10 bags in a pile at various intervals. The idea being to preserve the rice and prevent it being burnt in case it was left in the store. And then after the raid, it would then be taken back again. And as August appeared in 1945, we were told after the first atom bomb, Matsumoro said a new heat bomb had been dropped, and it melts glass. That's the only indication we had of the atom bomb. It was then after the second atom bomb that B-29s flew over Osaka and didn't drop any bombs. We could see the B-29s like silver fish. We knew they were 6 miles high, and the Japanese anti-aircraft fire couldn't reach, and neither could the Jap Zeros. Planes couldn't reach. And we could see the planes going up and looping and up again, but then they would have to come down, possibly short of fuel. They couldn't reach the planes. We also said there's something in the wind now that planes are coming across and not dropping. The guards gradually disappeared. And we did PT. We were made to do PT to keep ourselves fit, we were told. But a few days after that, planes came very low, American B-24s, and they dropped parachutes. Because then we, on the top of the go down where we were staying, we'd got some whitewash and put POW on the top of the camp, on the top of the roof. And then they dropped parachutes. The Americans dropped parachutes, canisters full of chickens, spam, tinned meat, tinned sausages, food, clothing, boots, shoes, underwear, and then leaflets were dropped. And the leaflets were in several languages, and we then knew that the war was over. Personally, I'd always fancied chicken. And I remember going out of the camp, and nobody stopped me because there was no guards there. And I walked about half a mile away, and found some chickens that had still survived the bombing and came back with a big cockerel and brought it back to the camp, and we plucked it and we had this cockerel.
How did the POWs behave towards the Japanese once they knew that the war was over?
Of course, they said, "I'd like to get my hands on Miyatake." Well, Miyatake had disappeared. Matsumura had gone. There were no guards to be found. All the guards had disappeared. There was only one who stayed, and he was an interpreter. And he stayed. And then we were told then by our own, we had a couple of officers with us, Lieutenant Pollock, Royal Navy, a Captain Brown in the Royal Corps of Signals, Lieutenant Buke was Royal Corps of Signals, and a Royal Scots Sergeant Major. And we were then told that we had to stay where we were and await the arrival of the invasion forces. A few days later, the first man I ever saw was a naval sub-lieutenant, and he came and he found us in our camp. And then he was able to tell us, put us in the picture and tell us that the war was over and that we were to stay together as communication would be made with us and arrangements made for necessary medical checkups. And in due course, hopefully, you'll all be home by Christmas. Then, as that time arrived, Americans arrived on the scene, and the American 8th Army. And Lieutenant Pollock, who was my senior officer in the camp, Royal Navy, and he said he wanted various people to stay behind after the initial bulk had been taken away to show the invasion forces Osaka and to take the Red Cross nurses and doctors to the various camps. And so I stayed behind for a couple of weeks. And I used to sit in front of a car and then take them round to the various camps, to Ichioka and to various other camps, where they would then draw a map in the car on how to get there again. Once having done that, the American 8th Army officers arrived, and I got a very nice letter of commendation from the American General Eichelberger, which I've got there, thanking me for all the assistance that I'd given them when they arrived and able to take them around. After that, we went to Tokyo. And we were in Tokyo, medical examinations, interrogations by the intelligence. They wanted all the information they could get about Japanese atrocities, names, particularly names and ranks if possible, what they'd done and where they were. We all underwent this interrogation. After a few days in Osaka, in Tokyo, I then flew to Okinawa. And there again, I was in Okinawa for some time. Again, medical checks. And then down to Manila. I went down to the Philippines, and it took a long time, quite a few weeks, for us to all to be sorted out. Eventually, I got an American ship, a Marine Shark was her name, and we sailed from Manila across the Pacific Ocean to San Francisco. San Francisco, again in an American Navy camp. More medical examinations, more checks. And then a train to Canada, across Canada, 1 week on the train, and then south to New York. And we caught the Queen Mary, as she was then used as a troop ship, back to Southampton.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment in the hands of the Japanese has left any long-term effects with you?
Oh, I think it did. I was very erratic. Although I did decide that if I was medically fit after my period of leave, it was my intention to stay on in the Navy. And in March 1946, I went for a further examination, and the Royal Naval medical surgeon said that if I wished to leave the Navy, I may do so. But if I wanted to stay, then I was certainly medically fit to do so. But of course, having been away all this time, I was very junior in rank with my compatriots. I met people in Devonport who joined the Navy the same day as me, and they'd been chief petty officers for years, and I was still only a junior rating. However, I did do a course, and I passed for petty officer, which was a big step, and then I was backdated for the 4 years odd that I was away, which was and then in 1950 I passed the chief petty officer's examination, and then I stayed in the Navy then until I took my pension.
How do you feel about the Japanese today?
Well, I think the same now, because the Japanese, there's no feeling in the Japanese face. If you look at a Japanese eyes, and you look at an Englishman's eyes, you can tell an Englishman if he's happy or if he's sad by looking at his eyes. But you can't a Japanese. You don't know if he's going to kick you in the shins or whether he's going to say that you've done some good work today. And my own personal feeling is that the Japanese, if they had the opportunity, they'd do it again. They have a small island with 100 million people. They've got their eyes on other places, I'm sure. Australia, for instance, which is such a vast continent. And I'm sure, I don't know whether the Australian government is inviting the Japanese there now to become residents or not, but it looks to me that Japan is so swollen that they will, given the opportunity. They had their eyes on China because it was so vast, but China's got a population problem as well. But I still feel that I wouldn't trust the Japanese. Whatever they say, they will do something else. And it amazes me, really, today, that we have so many people in this country who have religious services about the poor 80,000 people who were killed at Hiroshima, and the poor people who were killed by the atom bomb in Nagasaki. But they make no mention of the many, many thousands of British, American, Australian people who were murdered by the Japanese during the war.
Did you have any feelings when recently the Japanese Emperor was honoured in Britain?
I did indeed. And I thought when the Japanese Emperor presented the Archbishop of Canterbury with a cloak or garment of his regalia, and I thought, well, how people can forget. After the war, I received a letter from the War Office. After the war, I had a letter from the War Office asking, would I give my name, rank, and regiment? And I wrote back to the War Office and said, I was in the Royal Navy, and my name, rating, and official number, and inquired as to how or why the inquiry should be made. When I arrived home in Southampton, apparently the names of the POWs who returned from Japan were listed in one of the London newspapers. And my name had been seen by somebody who lived in London. This is absolute coincidence that there should have been another man, my identical name, who was in Singapore and who died in Singapore. I had occasion to go to Singapore again after the war, and I went to Kranji Cemetery, and there on the cenotaph is my name. It's rather an eerie feeling to see your name on a cenotaph when this man was a private in a Suffolk regiment. But he was, in fact, the same name as myself. It was an experience that not many people will have witnessed. I learnt a lot. I learnt good friends, and I learnt the difference between good and bad friends. And when Far East prisoners of war get together at any time, I think it's understandable how they have a togetherness, and how they speak a language amongst themselves, which many people who are not aware will never understand. And some of the greatest friends I have now, of course, are ex-Japanese prisoners of war. Of the six that I used to attend a reunion in the Royal Festival Hall each October, I used to get six tickets, send one to London, Taunton, Derby, Rosyth in Scotland, Leighton Buzzard in Bedfordshire, and myself, and the six of us would meet at Waterloo Station, and then we'd have a really wonderful time in the Royal Festival Hall at the reunion. But regrettably, four of those six have died since the end of the war, and most of them in their 50s. One has emigrated to Australia to be where his son is, and there's myself remaining. I'm quite sure that had it not been for the experiences in Japan, the men who died around the age of 50 would have been still alive today.